I will call a meeting to order. Council President Lynn Peterson and Councilor Ted Dirksen are excused. And I will now ask Councilor Gonzalez from the prestigious District 4 to provide our safety briefing.
Thank you. Please note that we are on the third floor of the building. In the event of a fire or fire alarm, please exit out through the door in the northeast corner of this room. Go down the steps to the second floor and exit through the main street, the main entrance by the reception desk. We will meet in the courtyard outside that entrance. In the event of a medical or fire emergency, please call 911 and notify the security agent at the front desk. The nearest defibrillator is mounted on the steps leading from the reception desk down to Grand Avenue. A fire extinguisher is located in the corridor along the side of the dais just behind the wall.
Thank you, Councilor Gonzalez. Our first work session topic. Yes, we did have an announcement from Councilor Craddock.
Thank you. I just wanted to remind you that today is the first Tuesday of the month, and this is the day that I'll leave at 3:15 to attend Southwest Washington's Regional Transportation Council meeting in Vancouver.
We'll try to be as efficient with our time as possible.
She's already late because she has to go rest.
Yes.
I go 7 miles. It takes 45 minutes.
It takes... Somebody needs to do something about the traffic, is what we like to say.
Somebody should do that.
Okay, our first topic is recycling update. And Matt Corot and Pam Peck, Metro staff, are here to lead our presentation.
Good afternoon, Deputy Council President Chase, councilors. This is Pam Peck. I'm Matt Cora. We're managers within the Property and Environmental Services Department. Today's discussion is a continuation of the work session discussion we had on September 3rd, where we talked about improvements that need to be made, that could be made to the recycling system to make it stronger and more resilient over the long term. Pam and I have about 15 minutes of presentation today, which will leave us plenty of time for the discussion, which is really the focus of today's session. So just to briefly bring you back to that September 3rd meeting, we came together because we wanted to give you an update on some existing work and get your input regarding future work that was a response to some of the challenges and opportunities in our regional recycling system. As you all recall, some of those changes most predominantly were the changes to international markets for recyclables, particularly from the results of what happened with the Chinese market. That's kind of the back end of the system, but we also talked about some of the challenges represented at the front of the system, where we have an increasing variety and amount of packaging types that influence our ability to manage that material at the end of its life. We also talked about some of the opportunities that existed despite the dynamism of the international recycling system coming out of the China changes. We still saw this region getting its materials recycled. We also have some positive signs by investment being made in our regional recycling system. Those are both private investments by the companies that do this work and public investments, particularly from Metro through its Investment and Innovation Grant Program. And then we also talked a little about some positive signs on the horizon, with new markets starting to develop in the U.S. and North America, particularly in paper, but also in some other areas as well, which was a response to the closing off of those markets at other parts of the country. So in our comments to you, we gave you the update, and we talked about the work that Metro and its local and state government partners were doing, along with private sector service providers, to stabilize the system in the short term, and most importantly, to try and identify what are the long-term actions that could be taken to get us back on track and really on solid footing for the future. We then asked for your input on how Council would like to be engaged in this work. And as you may recall, we had a pretty robust discussion about what councilors would like to see and what the Council as a whole would like to see. And it's represented in these 4 points, and you may remember others as well. We had talked about how we were collaborating in a statewide process with those partners I mentioned earlier. And Council's guidance to us was to continue to collaborate with our statewide partners But don't be beholden to the statewide process's timeline and outcomes. While that's valuable, we want to make sure that we're making decisions that are the best for this region. So that was part of your guidance. That was a main thrust of your guidance. Related to that, you said, let's get going. So you asked us to come back within a three-month period, bringing you options for actions that Metro could take to make the system more robust, more resilient, stronger over time, and for those actions, for those options for the actions to be all completable within a two-year period. So what you would do would happen within that two-year period. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about those actions today. You also noted that within 6 to 9 months, you'd like to see a public-private partnership put in place, particularly as it relates to end markets. Because of that more extended timeline we have, that's not going to be a focus of our discussion today, but we'll come back to you to discuss that. And then at that meeting and in subsequent conversations we had with some of you, you said that while we want to continue to down this path of making our overarching recycling system, particularly the one that deals with curbside materials, stronger, more resilient, you had some other materials that you're interested in and wanted to bring into this discussion. So we're going to talk about those today as well. So most specifically, we'll talk about the options, and then here are the questions that we'd like to pose to you today and for which we'd like your guidance and information. And these will show up again on the last slide as well. So we've organized the actions into three substantive groupings, and Pam will go through the details of each action within this organizing structure. There are interrelationships between each of those three areas, so there's not as if there's, you know, firm lines between each of them, but we thought this would be a helpful grouping for you to be able to most clearly see what we're trying to achieve with each element. So the first one is fairly self-explanatory. We're going to talk about the food service items, the things that you're used to seeing in restaurants, in delis, and grocery store takeouts. And then the second area is really about big changes, changes that have a big impact and a lot of work to make them happen. And Pam will describe what we mean by extended producer responsibility and also what we mean by performance standards for material recovery facilities. And then that last area gets to those other materials that you've identified and we'll talk about. We also thought it would be useful for you to see all the potential actions laid out in a timeline format. So we have the substantive grouping, and then we have this timeline format. And this is in your packet as attachment C. In this format, actions from each of those three substantive areas are commingled, and they reflect the fact that they can be carried out in parallel tracks to each other. Just to clarify, in the left-hand column where we've got the year and the quarters, that's calendar year references. I'm not going to read them all, but as you look at them, I'll just note that they represent different types of potential council actions. So, for instance, there are three council resolutions in there, and those would be essentially statements of an intent to act. And then in there also are corresponding actions, the actual acting to implement those resolutions, and those will most likely take the form of ordinances if you go, if you direct us to go down these paths. And then there are a couple others that are a little bit different than those, but you'll see this throughout Pam's discussion. There's some different mechanisms to advance this work. So I'm going to turn it over to Pam now, who's going to go through those substantive areas and their actions in detail.
Thank you, Matt. And once again, I'm Pam Peck, and it may be easier. So all the material that's on the screen is in your packet, and I'm really going to speak to these tables that were in the packet, so it may be a little easier for those. For those who are in the audience, I hope you can find them online or over there, because I'm sorry that the type is so small. So this first area, as Matt mentioned, addresses single-use food service items. These items include small items like stirrers and utensils, as well as the plastic clamshell containers with which we're all very familiar. Council actions in this area would reduce single-use disposable food serviceware and/or takeout packaging, with an emphasis on plastics, to reduce waste and litter and associated environmental and human health impacts. So I just want to take a second to describe terms. So we are focused on the food sector, kind of with these two items of things. And when I'm talking about food serviceware, those are the things that we need to actually, like, eat the food. Like, we need a fork, so that would be a food serviceware. When you get that salad to go, it would come with a fork, food serviceware, and a package, the clamshell container. And basically, these things have been handled differently in other policies, so we're kind of distinguishing them differently. So I can answer more questions on that if you'd like. But I'll just continue to unpack it here. So the goals of these actions are particularly those focused on single-use plastics we feel are really broadly supported by the public and by many key stakeholders, including restaurants and other impacted businesses. Really, the question is, what's the best path to get there in this region to using more sustainable options? The actions in this area build on each other. So the first action on the slide would be the council making a broad statement by resolution that you intend to act to address single-use plastics. You could focus that more broadly on a range of single-use plastics that aren't just food-focused, or you could focus more specifically on food service items that I've discussed. Right off the bat, the second action has you adopting in 2020 a regional by request by customer requirement for stirrers, utensils, and individually packaged condiments for dine-in, drive-through, takeout, or delivery. This would essentially extend the City of Portland's by-request policy across the region. Now, the state took care of straws in the last legislative session. So across the whole state, straws are by request. And what we mean by request is the customer has to ask for the item. So when items are just sitting out, people take lots of them that they never use. And as we know, the things that go into takeout bags are the things that are likely to end up as litter. This first action is very focused on items that end up as plastic litter. So I just want to so it would extend that region-wide. If the council were to adopt a regional by-request policy, implementation steps would really include community awareness and working with the business community and providing technical assistance. The next two actions would address a broader list of food service materials, and those are the two on the bottom of the table. And they're really focused on the reduction of single-use food service packaging for both takeout and dine-in eating. So this would include disposable deli containers of any kind of material, plastic, whatever they're made out of. Those things that you think of as clamshells, which are made out of all different kinds of plastic, and like disposable coffee cups. Those are just examples of food service packaging that could be included. So in 2020, the council would adopt a resolution stating its intent to ban, in 2022, single-use food service takeout packaging that cannot be recycled in local programs, and to support efforts by the business community to shift to recyclable and reusable food service packaging. This would lead to action in late 2021 to put the ban in place to take effect the following year. Staff would recommend that during the period from resolution to ban, Metro would consider providing incentives such as grants to help food service businesses make this transition to reusables or to more recyclable or more sustainable or environmentally beneficial alternatives. This would be in addition to providing education and technical assistance. We expect there would be opposition from packaging producers and food service businesses whose products wouldn't meet these requirements. Conversely, we know there is really broad public support for moving away from disposable single-use items for eating our food and towards more sustainable options. Prior to Council's consideration of any type of ordinance, Metro would need to work with the community and stakeholders. This would include potentially impacted businesses to inform a specific policy. Consultation with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, ORLA, who have been really a key partner in Metro's food scraps policy work, would be part of this engagement, as with consultation with our venues, who would also be affected by a policy such as this. Okay, so that was food service items. I'm going to talk next about systemic changes in the system. And this area really focuses on changes that would have system-wide impact. These actions are heavier lifts than some of the others we're presenting today, but they really carry the potential for correspondingly significant positive impacts on the recycling system. These actions would advance the public's interest related to how the system is managed, how it's funded, and it would set standards for outcomes, accountability, and transparency that the system lacks today. The first action is focused on establishing extended producer responsibility for paper and plastic packaging and printed paper, which is about 40% of the waste in most of our households. That's things like junk mail and all the plastic packages, boxes, and bags, right, that all the things are coming in this time of year, they would all be covered by that. It's all the packages around the products we buy. As a reminder, extended producer responsibility, which is often called EPR for short, requires producers to take responsibility for the full life cycle of their product, and that includes the recycling of that product. Oregon, as you know, has established programs in place for paint and electronics, and in the last legislative session, a new drug take-back bill for pharmaceuticals was established at the state level. Around the U.S., EPR laws cover a number of products in 33 states and the District of Columbia, and many provinces in Canada, as well as countries in Europe, have established EPR systems for paper and packaging. EPR policies shift responsibility for recycling with government oversight upstream to the producer and away from the public sector. EPR laws for packaging and paper would provide sustainable funding for recycling by shifting the burden from governments and taxpayers to packaging producers and brand owners. And by brand owners, I mean Procter & Gamble and Johnson & Johnson and large brand companies like that. EPR policies can also be designed to provide incentives to these producers to make packaging that incorporates more environmental considerations, such as recycled content or something like that. EPR programs typically work best on a statewide basis, so the first action on the top of the slide is intended to give the Oregon legislature an opportunity to pass packaging and printed EPR legislation in the 2021 legislative session. The Metro Council would adopt a resolution in 2020 calling on the state to do this and stating Metro's intent to move forward and take action at the regional level if the state fails to act. The second item would be if the state doesn't act, what would Metro do? And Metro would look at enacting a regional EPR policy. Developing EPR programs takes a lot of stakeholder convening, and the amount that Metro would need to do would really depend on what kind of played out during the legislative session. But we can expect stakeholders and lobbyists from product producers, retailers, and e-commerce platforms, as well as recycling system stakeholders, would all be involved in this process. We know many of these stakeholders around the country have opposed EPR at both the state and local level, but we feel there's likely broad public support for an EPR policy focused on paper and packaging. The next set of council actions to advance systemic change are on the bottom half of the slide. And those are really focused on the facilities that sort our materials collected through our public recycling programs. The first action would support continued modernization of those facilities through Metro's Innovation and Investment Grant Program. Making this funding available is really part of Metro's commitment to the important role played by these facilities. The second proposed action would expand Metro's regulatory oversight of these facilities on behalf of the public that participates in recycling programs. Metro would establish performance standards. Those would include sorting outcomes, meaning that we would need to see materials sorted in a way that makes them most acceptable to end markets. We would also want to see end market certifications for environmental and social sustainability. We expect there would be strong public support for those certifications and the improved transparency that they would provide related to end markets because of concerns about how materials are handled when they're recycled during and after the recycling process. And I'm referring now to the videos you've probably seen or heard where you've seen in some countries where recycling is really carried out in very deplorable conditions for the communities, the workers, and the local environment. So essentially these certifications would be getting at knowing our materials are not flowing to those markets. Last area is about some of the harder to recycle items in our system, or harder to manage items, and one of those is mattresses. Councillors Craddock, Stacey, and Chase in particular have been interested in some time in seeing a more robust system of mattress recycling in the region. The most effective way of doing this would be through an extended producer responsibility policy at the state or regional level. We do expect to see a mattress EPR bill introduced in the 2020 Oregon legislative short session. And as with the packaging EPR approach I just talked about, the proposed actions here are really in two parts. First, Council would adopt a resolution encouraging the state to take action in 2020 and stating Metro's intent to take action at the local level if the state doesn't act. And if there's no action at the state level, the next step would be for the council to consider a regional policy later in 2020. Metro would convene stakeholders to inform development of this. And this policy could include a disposal ban, which a number of you have also suggested would be something we should look at. We expect there would be support from the public and recyclers for this action and likely some industry opposition. A lot of stakeholder work was already done in the 2019 legislative session, so we can really build on that. And finally, the last area of action is one that doesn't require direct council action other than through a budget approval process. As a bridge to the time when there's extended producer responsibility in place for plastic packaging, this action would propose that we develop a robust depot system and mobile collection system for some plastics, including styrofoam, that are difficult for residents to recycle but have some end markets available to them. These are materials that either have had some end market limitations, like maybe you can't collect enough to get to an end market in the past, or they're hard to collect. Like styrofoam is very hard to collect through a regular collection because it blows all around, so it's probably never going to be collected that way. So through conversations with end markets, we think we really could create an alternative system that would provide an outlet for these materials where there are markets available. So I know that was a lot of information packed into a short amount of time, and happy to answer any questions after we get through.
So we're done with the presentation part. As Pam said, we recognize that was a lot of information. Our questions are on the right-hand side. Thought it would be helpful for you, again, to see the options before you all in one place, and this timeline format was the easiest way to do that. With that, Deputy Council President Chase, I'll turn it over to you to guide discussions and questions to us.
Sure. I'm guessing there's going to be some questions and comments on this topic, so who would like to start?
I don't have a question. I just really appreciate going bold. That's what we need to do, and to really begin to catalyze this discussion in our state. And hopefully the state legislature will help us with this, but if not, I'm more than glad to support us taking action regionally.
Councilor Stacey.
I've been justly accused of being a regulator and enforcer for most of my career, most of it in land use rather than plastics recycling. But I'm enthusiastic about this, no surprise. I'm interested to learn, you know, what adverse effects folks in the business anticipate. But I come to it with enthusiasm rather than skepticism. So I'm not a good person to start the dialogue other than saying, let's get going.
Councilor Gonzalez.
Thank you, Councilor. I have questions. I wrote down the words approach to compliance and market certification just because those appealed to me. End market certification, is there an international organization that designates the standard, or would we have to develop our own program and send staff to visit? What would that look like?
Yeah, there is the Basel Action Network, which is starting to focus on plastics, which has been more focused on electronics. And historically, these things have been hard to track and manage, right? So there'd be some starting places, but really there aren't a lot of strong programs out there that are really doing this at this point. The best models would be what we see for our e-waste, and so that would provide a potential model for us to follow here.
Okay, interesting. So from what I've been able to discern from my time on the council, I've learned that and at times a jurisdiction can send, you know, different loads of recycling material, and different receiving entities might not manage it to what we would expect and assume they would, whether it's depot right by the bay or right by the water, and plastic just falls over, it's not managed appropriately. So that's kind of the visual I have in my mind, and I think that if most voters or residents knew that that might be happening, it'd be very alarming. But nonetheless, approach to compliance, I'm really curious to hear in the future what tools we would have to ensure that we can implement these things. Obviously, the commercial food scraps program has been a learning opportunity in terms of engaging with jurisdictions. I will let you know that I am supportive of are options two, three, and six. in terms of where I would like Metro to move. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilor Lewis.
So I have a number of thoughts, and being in the minority here today, not a solid waste liaison. Some of this I'm seeing more for the first time. So a couple of more scattered thoughts. So in terms of developing a policy for single-use items, I'm generally supportive, although looking at the straw rollout, particularly from the perspective of having friends in the service industry, there's a lot of lessons learned, and I don't want us to get any further along without actually doing not just like engagement and partnership, but some real learning. So to not have Orla here today is, I'm already feeling like we're a little bit on our heels, and I hope that we engage with them because we have words on paper. It's real. We need to start that conversation yesterday. In addition, I hope that we reach out to partners and agencies dealing with human services. There's a lot of single-use items in the healthcare sector, folks who do work with vulnerable populations and the homeless, and how we can either intentionally engage or exclude those groups. But I think we actually really need to learn about the challenges a little bit more broadly than just kind of the traditional restaurant setting that those of us with good intentions start with. In terms of styrofoam and hard-to-recycle plastics, like, that's the one where I'm like, we're at the starting gate, and, like, let's get going soon. Whereas I think the pace here is, like, we're doing some of these other things that are more relational faster than the styrofoam and the hard-to-recycle plastics. And I'm struggling with the mattress timeline, honestly. I think this is maybe the first conversation that we're having where we're saying we're going to do this, legislature, if you don't. And I'm heartened to hear that there is a bill. We always get to this point where it's, we've got will, we've got a vehicle. The stickiness in the past has been ways and means. Ways and means in a short session is really different than ways and means in a long session. I want us to go at it, but I also just want to recognize that we're in kind of the last two-month window to be saying, you know, we've got a lot of pressure and a lot of eggs in this basket. It feels a little strained. So I'd say let's proceed, but I guess after this legislative session, I'd like to check in on how the conversation goes before we just move forward one way or the other.
Well, I'll chime in that I really appreciate the quick response in terms of and meeting the spirit of urgency that we really impressed upon you, I think, when we had our last conversation, and the importance of really acting quickly on one of the issues that is one of the most important issues of our day. So I think you're in the right place in terms of bringing these forward and pursuing the quickest timelines that we can. I'm interested. Of course, we also, I know, as you've always approached these issues, balanced it with making sure we're getting it right so that it's accepted in the community. And I hope that the fact that there aren't best practices, as many best practices as we'd like, I hope that we are collecting and learning from everyone we can, as I think is our tradition, and I think we would expect and is how we tend to move forward. We also want to be an entity that is sharing and creating best practices and promising practices as we go. And so making sure that we get that balance right so that as we approach these issues, they are integrated really with our communities in a way that they're embraced and effective. So I guess in that spirit, you know, how do you see, could you talk a little more about the process part and the stakeholder engagement? You talked about, in some cases, the stakeholder engagement. you know, there's mattresses, there's the plastic, there's the, you know, restaurant, there's different entities and different, is it, could you talk a little more about how the stakeholder engagement and process and whether we're piloting some things and testing them out and seeing where the challenges may occur as we go. Can you talk a little more about that and sort of how we can really understand that the community will be in the best possible place in terms of their input in this process?
Yeah, sure. I'll start with an overview, and then Pam can provide some specific details. I mean, we did not, as staff, make a recommendation to you in our presentation, but I think one of the things that we consider valuable in how these options are laid out is these cases where we have first a resolution and then the opportunity for council to take action depending on other factors or just depending on your own desire, because that creates the space to either ensure that we have our own complete and full and robust metro-led engagement with all the partners to which you've alluded and the affected parties to which Councillor Lewis and others alluded, or the opportunity to build off the stakeholder engagement that might have taken place in the statewide discussions. Pam and I absolutely hear Councillor Lewis's caution on the speed of the mattress work. One of the reasons we're a bit comfortable with that is because mattress bill was introduced in the 2019 session and had a lot of robust stakeholder input. So we want that. We see value in that ability in both the product packaging and the mattresses to build off the other stakeholder engagement that's occurred. There's two types of best practices we want to use in this work. One is, I think, the one that you clearly alluded to, is what's being done elsewhere that we can learn from. And as Pam said, in the very complex world of extended producer responsibility, we've led in a couple areas, like the paint, but we're not a leader overall in North America or North American Europe. So there's much to learn from those experiences, both in terms of how to develop them and what's the component of it. And then the second critically important thing is you'll remember that racial equity is an underlying framework for our regional waste plan work, which guides this efforts. And so our engagement starts with that framework and that perspective. And we ensure that in addition to the traditional stakeholders, we build on our existing network of relationships with the community-based organizations, with Metro's Committee on Racial Equity, with our Regional Waste Advisory Committee, to ensure that those voices are heard. So that's, I know those are at a high level, but all those lead to the structure and the time we take to do this work. The dates we've given you here are really initiation dates of the work. Some of these are pretty simple, the resolutions, but the development of the actual programs that will come back to you to implement are complex, and we need the time to develop those because of the reasons that you said, Councillor Chase, because of that need to engage with the stakeholders. And some of these are pretty complex. We have the traditional stakeholders and our equity stakeholders, and traditional I mean some of the industry folks and the local governments, but we're bringing in new ones. We talked a little bit with our solid waste liaisons about that, is we and you will start to see the faces that fly in from D.C. To talk to you.
Better suits and shoes than we wear.
Better suits and shoes than I wear, at least. I'm not going to say to you.
You and I, that's all I'm talking about.
Can't all be Juan Carlos.
So that complexity is definitely there. And when we come back to you for the implementing actions on any of those, we will have those details for you to help us improve. All of these take more work.
And my other question is kind of a little more specific, but it just comes to mind that kind of thinking about the single-use food packaging and utensils all kind of wrapped up in my mind, which is, you know, we've sort of backed off in terms of composting. We've backed off some policies that we've had around including certain kinds of items in our composting, cardboard, you know, biodegradables. Do you see a look at and potential kind of areas for putting those ideas back on the table in terms of saying, hey, we need to be a little more open about if we are going to make some really structural changes, looking at and potential in those areas as well.
I think we're open to always continuing the conversation. But at least from my perspective as staff, there's still a kind of a high hurdle for those materials to go through. The challenge with them is even if they are benign in the composting process, and they're never more than benign, no better than benign, they don't add anything to the finished product. But even if they're relatively benign, they have this interesting impact on human behavior, is when you put something in that's truly compostable within the processes that exist at the private businesses in our state, they serve like a magnet to bring in items that look alike but aren't alike. And that's where our original policy at our transfer stations really was focused, because they tend to attract other materials and that aren't compostable under anybody's standards and just become a contamination and trash issue. So we can be open to that. We've encouraged those manufacturers to start by talking to the compost facilities. I mean, our decisions here are not just based on what the compost facilities say, but they're operators and we value their input, and until that barrier of is overcome with how they actually can be successfully integrated without some of those downsides. I'll be honest, we're reluctant, but happy to always keep talking with that industry. And happy to help them make the case that there may be benefits to those from a life cycle environmental perspective that don't depend on how they're handled at the end of their life. They still may be preferable to the plastics. Mm-hmm.
I always kind of have, this is now, and I'm really going down this road, but I'm going to take advantage of this time. I always wondered if there was some sort of certification process that could happen where, if you're a school or a university or a facility where there's a large venue, if you had, certified as using only biodegradable materials, is there some sort of process that could, allow folks to add compostables in certain situations? It's just an idea. You don't even have to.
I'll just say the U of O went down this path with their game, with their events, even to creating something that was like a colored utensil, and then they ended up going away from it. So that's a whole history. You could, because of what Matt said, they just attract all these other things in. So, but they went through so many steps. That would be a case study you could look at to try to really find a way to do exactly what you're saying.
Somebody thought it was a good idea once, and now they realized it was a bad idea, is what I'm hearing.
No, just that you can't overcome that human behavior of people putting the other things in there. That's the problem, not that the idea is bad.
No, I understand. I understand. Thank you.
What I'd love to see is us explore that notion that you had is with generators of a significant amount, can we work with the industry to actually do a closed-loop recycling of those that doesn't depend on their scattered integration into the composting system, but actually have it go back into their manufacturing process, which they say is absolutely possible and desirable, but neither the industry nor the government side has invested much effort in figuring out, okay, is there a way to get a collection program that something can work? But be happy to keep looking at that.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. Councilor Craddock.
Thank you. Thank you first for the presentation. But what I noticed a lot of it is focused on the food industry. And so I was sitting here thinking about where else is plastic accruing from and what industries. And I have this, I do a lot of walking, and it's like because I walk, I end up starting to pick up litter along the road. And it's amazing how much litter now is because of the marijuana industry, where people purchase marijuana in these little plastic vials, and then they just toss them out on the road as they drive by. And then I'm thinking about the hotels. I know there's some hotel that are beginning to not use those little shampoo and conditioner and lotion containers in the guest rooms, but move to dispensers. So how does products like that begin to get rolled into this? Is that something that would come later as you after you roll out these first steps, and we then begin to think about other industries, other products that might are generators of a lot of plastic? How do you go through evaluating those kinds of sources of plastic that aren't food related?
Yeah, I think we'd be looking at what are those other sectors that are out there. So the example you had of the marijuana containers, those are mostly small. Those are a good example of something we could look at for the hard to collect plastics depot we just talked about. So if there was a market that we could find for those, they're too small really to go into the collection system now. So maybe they could be collected through the depot system. And I think the focus on, you know, there is a big movement away from the little toiletry bottles that's happening, you know, across the lodging industry. But we could do some research and bring back, like, where are more of those other items? Like, right, cigarette butts, I think, are the biggest piece of plastic litter out there. Just in terms of where you're interested, if it's more litter or other things you're looking at with plastics.
Well, I'm thinking the marijuana industry, why do they even have to use plastic? I would think they could use
They're required by the state OLC, yes, to do that. And so that's why there actually might be a bit of an opportunity there, because there's already the OLCC kind of provides oversight over the state's container beverage deposit system. So maybe there's some potential there as well. But, yeah, they're required to use those containers and those little bags, those little flexible film bags. So they're required to use those by state law.
And I would just add that either as we prepare for influencing and informing statewide EPR on packaging or our own, there's this opportunity to have discussions about what we want to see involved, included in there. It doesn't have to be just the food service items. It can be those other items, as you mentioned.
Well, part of this is making sure that we're fair, that we aren't always focusing on one industry. That all, I mean, anybody that's producing plastic, we all have a responsibility in that. And so thinking about what process do we use to begin to implement those other industries, sectors that produce plastic, and how we hold that in. Now, I recognize that's years away. We have plenty to do now, but I was just more curious about how you begin to think about that.
Yeah, I think we can look at the realm of things that we see, particularly in the litter world and the waste world, and also look at where there are good models. So Councillor Lewis has been advocating some of the work in the lodging industry. Scott and is obviously a liaison to that. And that's an area where, as Pam alluded to, they're going to probably get there on their own, that industry, because of some leaders. And now, as you notice, when you go to almost any lodging, there's communication about sustainability. And that's gone from towels and washing to the containers. And so I kind of personally think that industry is going to solve itself. But there's still an opportunity to include those in programs like this. And I think the marijuana industry is also another one where there's some opportunity as well. We actually had an interesting investment innovation grant proposal from one manufacturer of those items last year. The proposal was weak in some other areas. We hope they'll come back, but it was to address both recyclability and reusability of those containers, operating within the constraints of OLCC on how they're handled.
Councilor Gonzalez.
Matt and Pam, and I have to apologize for earlier. I'm so used to the alternatives and picking one per section that I picked one per section instead of now I'm realizing that it's more so of the whole suite of things in terms of what the staff is willing to. So I apologize, and I did misread them in terms of thinking, all right, if we had to pick one or the other in each section. I'm looking at the policy question again to reground myself in the conversation, and I'm wondering if you feel like you feel like you have direction as to what you should begin to develop and implement, or if you felt like, for the most part, we've said that we welcome and we're supportive of these things.
Thank you, Councilor Gonzalez. I say we would appreciate a perhaps more explicit direction. You're absolutely right, Councilor Gonzalez, that this doesn't have to be a pick and choose from each section. We can do all of these if that interests you. I think the main distinguishing factors are either if there's a subject area you're not interested in working, or if, say, you didn't like this notion of letting the state play out first, then that's an opportunity to take a couple off. But if you're comfortable with the topic areas and you're comfortable with this kind of iterative approach to mattresses and the packaging of give the state a chance to go on record, give the state a chance to act, act if they don't act, then as a slate, this is all doable.
I fully support the plan that you've put together here. I definitely agree and support the notion that we need to give our state legislature the opportunity to take the first step. But if they don't, we then take action. What is the region? 40% of the state's population, and so that, I think it carries a pretty big, message that this is really important, that we need to, and hopefully that will give them impetus and support in the work that they want to do, because I definitely know there's interest. But I think this will, over time, will sort out. Because we have the industry representatives here today, they'll give their input. They might have some good suggestions that we're not considering, working with the state legislature. So I personally would like to see the whole suite be considered, but I'm expecting that they will sort themselves out as we move through the process, because of the various partners that you need to work with that will modify this plan to some degree over time.
I would add also, one, that Councilor Gonzalez did answer the questions, so you actually were correct in answering the questions. But I think we've also sort of organically had this conversation such that it's really about what's the process moving forward and keeping these on the table, and with some, it's been about the process, and then because these are all pretty big components, so it's the stakeholders, it's the community, it's the conversation with council continuing forward. We're not saying, at this point, as I'm reading, we're not saying, yes, we're doing these. We're saying, here's some input on the process to determine how to move forward on these, and these as a package look like promising areas to spend our staff and council capacity evaluating and working with our stakeholder partners. Does that sound fair?
Yes, and I would just say yes. You're giving us a charge to go work on what we're going to bring back to you.
Councilor Stacey.
I'm persuaded by Councilor Lewis's observations about what month it is with respect to the 2020 legislative session. It, frankly, might be more respectful simply to proceed with our mattress strategy and do the notice to the legislature for the later elements of this program, giving the legislature an opportunity to act statewide on where's the next notice to the legislature in this list? The council mattress resolution that says if the legislature doesn't act in 2020, just before the 2020 short session begins, probably is ineffective. If we need some kind of legislative action to proceed, which I don't believe we do, I guess we ask when we have to. But in this case, it's notice in case you want to act. We're going to do it anyway. So why don't we just start doing it? I may be missing some fundamental issue, but I don't understand what it is.
I think we might wait till the session is done then, which, right, is like the first or second week in March.
Yeah.
Because let the stakeholders play it out at the state level. Is that what I hear you saying? Just let it kind of play out during the short session, and then
will it be in the short session? If we
we hear that it will is like very likely to be introduced in the short session.
So in that
case, I would just clarify the only reason we put that
is because it's already on the docket.
Because talking to Randy, it's our understanding that there's a strong chance, very strong chance, it will be introduced, reintroduced.
Well, then we should proceed as you recommend and declare that unless the legislature acts in 2020, we will act in 21.
Thanks for calling us out.
I apologize for
muddling it up. We didn't state that clearly that we have, it's our understanding that it will be introduced.
Oh, I think it's a comprehension problem on my end.
Councilor Lewis.
Yeah, I guess the one thing that's now kind of popping out in this is action item 7, 2021 Q3, performance standards at MRFs. And we don't have any intermediate timeline there in terms of a step A before the standards go into place. And I know that there's staff level engagement, but this seems one that's kind of the biggest in terms of taking the system we already have and doing something to it as opposed to adding on. So I think that there is the need
absolutely,
for us to
absolutely
have touches on it before 2021.
Absolutely. So we would anticipate a full policy development process similar to any of the other issues we're working on with you, where we're checking in with you on work sessions, continuing to get direction, having a robust stakeholder engagement process. I think the only reason we had these other actions were these things that are going on in the legislature that we had heard from our conversations with councillors. There was an eagerness to act on. So just trying to lay out what was happening at the state level and how the council might get involved in that. But, yeah, absolutely. Each one of these needs its own robust, you know, engagement, stakeholder and public engagement strategy to be developed, and lots of interactions with all of you.
Great. Thank you.
And to follow up on that, my assumption based on what feels like obviously an expedited timeline for us to adopt a standard or a decision or at least to signal a decision is that there would be a phased approach of for the MRFs, if by Q3 of 2021 we say that there's going to be a standard. I'm assuming there's, you know, 5 year for similar to the commercial food scraps program, in which we set a target deadline of this is when it's going to be fully this, and here's how we're going to meet the goal. That's my assumption, not just 2021.
Yeah,
we're going to do this.
Right. We're assuming that's all the time it would take to develop the policy would be up until then, and then there'd be all of those considerations you just talked about for implementation, and there would also be a continued role for the grant program, I think, to help those companies meet standards potentially too.
Thank you.
I have a question, and I don't expect to be folded into this, but it's more curiosity. So is there a process that's being used throughout the U.S., somewhere else in the U.S., that helps with recycling that we don't have in this part of the region that we would like to bring this direction? And I don't know if you've considered that. What do we need to prepare for that and to bring a new technology here that would help us better recycle something? I don't know if you've done that. I recognize I'm kind of plopping this down in the middle of this. I'm not requesting it, but I just want to make sure that you've considered that and have done some research that what's really innovative out there that could really help us and be a value to us that we would like to support and to bring to this region, and that would create an economy that we don't have right now.
Yeah, so for me, I think there's technological processes and kind of the framework processes. So the EPR is huge for getting the type of outcomes that I think this council wants to see. And as we noted, there's models for that elsewhere that work. Not perfectly, not that don't need improvements, but they work. And so that's a really exciting area for this council, I think, to be considering. Technologically, I'm not sure there's some big thing out there that we're missing. Part of what goes into our discussions about what we can do and how we can do it relate to the amount of material we generate and what advantages we have in place that can leverage those technological opportunities. So you've heard us say this before. We don't always get all the opportunities in this state because of our relative population to places like California and Washington and others. But one of the reasons we can pursue, say, some of those hard-to-recycle plastics and styrofoam is because there are some opportunities with existing companies here that we may be able to partner with them to invest in their growth, to take advantage of their presence here, to take advantage of their desires to move away from their existing operating methods and standards and flows of material to do more in different things. Denton Plastics is one of them. Agilex is another of them. We are having really productive conversations with each of those companies, and we'll come back and talk to you about those conversations later on. So I think that's where opportunities are. We're also starting to see our material recovery facilities invest in more cutting-edge technologies to enable them to enhance their ability to build upon the really good work they're already doing, but really position us to meet those standards. And I think that'll be one of the interesting things, Councilor Gonzalez, when we come back to you in 2021 about the performance standards, that we'll see that most or all of the MRFs are already well positioned to meet those. And then I think the discussion will be around that complex area of certification. So it's a long way of saying I think we have some ability to do exciting work in both areas, leveraging off what we've got.
And then I'll just briefly add that the work going on right now that we're participating in around modernizing Oregon's system over the long term is really looking at your question from a statewide perspective, and we'll be actually looking at some different infrastructure models and comparing them to each other and comparing to the system we have today. So that's information that we would have this summer that would be, you know, we could dig into a lot more as we're starting to talk more about EPR and some of these other systems. But anyway, that'll be information that will be coming out of that process.
Thank you. I think that looks like all of our questions and comments. Thank you so much.
And our encouragement.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so are you clear on the next steps?
Yes.
Get busy and come back again.
That's it. Yeah. Thank you very much for the time and the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next item is legislative agenda, and we have Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager, somewhere up here.
Short hallway conversation.
They're working on their
agenda
for the mattresses.
I actually do have a comment on that topic. Good afternoon, councilors. Before I launch into my presentation, I want to introduce to you Annalisa Curler, who has joined us just a week ago through a very competitive recruitment as the new state and regional affairs advisor in the GAPD, Government Affairs and Policy Development Group unit, whatever we are.
Part of the COO Council Office.
Yes, part of the Council
Office.
Absolutely. Yes, a small arm of the Council Office. And I'd like to give Annalisa just a moment to introduce yourself before I launch into my harangue.
Yes, super excited to be here. Randy said, it is day 5, and so I feel like I'm drinking from a fire hose a bit. Spent the last 7 years at Oregon Food Bank doing a very similar job working down in Salem and here regionally on various policy issues, so super excited to be here. Thank you.
It's great. Thank you for being here.
She's already making me smarter and better. So I'd like to, my time is limited today with you, and I've also kind of streamlined, unless you drag it out, right?
Oh, yeah.
I was told I had a half an hour.
Are you now? You're why we're here.
Yeah, you all kind of, your faces all. Anyway, I'm going to try to be pretty streamlined in my presentation here, and I was much more streamlined than I have historically been in the materials that I've put in front of you. However, the reason for that is that there's not a lot of new information. At least at the time that I wrote these materials, there wasn't. Before I get into any of the issues, I think I just want to, because you just had this extended conversation about solid waste, and specifically you talked about the mattress issue, I just wanted to give you my one piece of input on that I've heard from a key legislator who would be hearing that bill. And we discussed whether it was helpful or not helpful for the council to take a to adopt a statement or position or resolution or whatever that would commit to doing something regionally if the legislature doesn't act. That could cut either direction, mm-hmm. So there's not any definitive statement here. But at the end of that conversation, the suggestion was that maybe the most helpful thing would be a simple resolution of support for the legislature acting and not necessarily a comment about what you might do if they don't. So that's just one piece of input from one legislator. I don't want to overstate it, but I just wanted to pass it along. Okay. And it is a legislator that will be hearing the bill in a committee that they sit on. Anyway, as I was saying, I think my time is relatively limited here today, and also we're missing a couple of counselors today. I'm going to try to make some opportunities in the next couple of weeks to follow up on a couple of things that I think might need deeper conversation than we're able to have today, just so you know. The other thing I wanted to quickly go over, unless there's something to specifically discuss, you know, as you know, every session I bring you a set of legislative principles, and occasionally there are some suggested changes to those legislative principles that I bring forward. Occasionally you suggest some changes to those legislative principles. We've made a few changes over the last few years. We've added a few principles, including one on racial equity. I think it's, you know, I've looked over it before submitting it to you again. It looks to me like it's fairly comprehensive, but I want to make sure that you have an opportunity over the next couple of weeks before I bring you a resolution adopting a legislative agenda. In case there's anything you feel either is missing or needs restatement, this is a window when you have an opportunity to give me some direction there. And as you know, I use these principles as sort of my policy book in a way. I mean, I rely on them to be able to make calls on moving legislation when there's not time for a major check back with the council. And they're very helpful to me, and I just wanted to mention them. They're in your packet today, and if there's anything that I need to modify, change, or augment, please do let me know today or later. Okay. So I also, in the memo that I submitted, the other memo, not the principles, I have a list of items that I think are not coming up in 2020, which we've worked on in the past. And I'm not going to go over those one by one, except to mention one of them. As you know, for the last few years, we've brought forward legislation to create a product stewardship program, or extended producer responsibility. I guess I should stick with the proper language after the last presentation, on household hazardous waste. And we've gotten that bill out of its policy committee three sessions in a row. It's died in Ways and Means. And most recently, it died this year in Ways and Means after getting out of committee very early in the session. There is a particular barrier, I believe, in the Ways and Means Committee that we're not likely to get passed in the short session. Our main sponsor on this bill, Representative McLean, suggested that we should probably not offer it this session, just due to the likelihood of getting it out. And so I didn't request a draft. As you know, this in the short session, legislators only have a very limited number of bills, in the Senate just one, and in the House just two per person that they can introduce anyway. And so there's a lot of competition for those slots, and a bill that may have a tough time doesn't usually warrant using one of those opportunities. And so I have not introduced that this session. I just want to let you know that and tell you why. In 2020, I'm going to speak about some of the issues in the part of the memo that says, yes, we expect to be working on these. I'm going to go over a few of them briefly and then leave a couple of them for a little bit deeper conversation. On transportation, I've had an update from the TriMet that they're not likely to be pursuing funding or policy around Southwest Corridor in this session. They've had extensive conversations with legislative leadership, and I think they're hanging on until the ballot measure that you're working on goes forward. And so I just wanted to let you know that. And so that's unlikely. I mean, that could change, but it's unlikely that we'll be making an ask during this legislative session, this short session on Southwest Corridor. As you know, it's a crazy session coming up. Also, with respect to the regional transportation ballot measure, we did get legislation last session that provides an opportunity for Metro to raise a significant amount of revenue from a regional vehicle registration fee. We've been examining a number of potential revenue sources for the measure that you're working on. Obviously, you and the task force have a lot of conversation yet to be had about those revenue sources, and I'm sort of, you know, ready to seek authority if necessary for any of those sources that may you know, emerge from the process. Right now, there's not an obvious candidate that staff has identified, but obviously things change. So I just want to keep a placeholder for that. I've already discussed.
Just one moment.
Yes.
Before you move on from transportation funding, Randy, TriMet's decision not to renew the proposal for a state participation in the local state regional match for a federal New Starts grant for Southwest Corridor nonetheless leaves the regional government making a proposal to the voters in 2020 that would include Southwest Corridor. And I expect that we will estimate a state contribution as
Absolutely.
Part of the leverage.
Yes.
And I want to make sure that the Legislative Assembly understands.
My understanding from, this is from one conversation last week, is not that there's a decision not to seek funding from the legislature for Southwest Corridor. It's that there's a decision not to seek it in the short session right now.
Right.
Just given the dynamics and other...
I don't want to be charged with false advertising when we include a dollar amount that the voters then act on.
Right.
And if that measure passes, there's an implicit commitment that we will ask the legislature for that money. And I'm happy to paint the legislature into as tight a corner as we can get them with an affirmative vote of 40% of the people of the state.
I don't believe there's any change in that larger strategy.
Okay.
Just to be clear. I just think that, you know, I had written into this little memo something about funding for Southwest Corridor. The ask for Southwest Corridor in the 2019 session was very limited as well.
Yeah.
So even if there were an ask this session, it wouldn't be for the entire expected state contribution to the project. There's been a strategic decision not to request that in the short session.
Gotcha.
But I don't think there's any change in the larger strategy. I'm not aware of any change in the larger strategy. So, I think we've discussed mattresses already. The champion of that, just to let you know, the sponsor of that is Senator Manning from Eugene. He has mattress recycling operation in his district. He was the sponsor of the bill in the 2019 session and has decided that this is his one bill that he's pursuing this session. And so we're working with him and with the committee, the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, make sure that that is successful. I included in my list the Willamette Falls Locks effort, but Councillor Lewis is a lot more conversant on it than I am. I'm playing a sort of gopher role on that one. Whenever anyone needs me to do anything, I'm there to do it. I'm not the leader of that effort, but I'm happy to step up in any way that's necessary to be successful. As you'll recall, the legislature declined to fund that project in 2019, but included a budget note articulating I think, a strong intent to do so in 2020 if questions of the ownership of the facility were resolved and those questions are being addressed in legislation that's forthcoming to create a public corporation to own and operate the locks. So I don't know if there's anything else to be said about that right now, Councillor, or any
other.
Very
nice summary.
Thank you. And finally, before we get to the two little bit bigger issues, I want to mention this is a big issue, but maybe not as big in the short session. A couple of pieces of housing legislation that passed last session, very, very momentous pieces of legislation. Obviously, you know about House Bill 2001, the missing middle bill, and House Bill 2003, which establishes a process for housing needs analyses around the state. Each of these bills has some technical issues that we're concerned with. We also have a couple of policy concerns in House Bill 2001, but there's no hurry on addressing those. In spite of those concerns, you'll recall that and I supported the legislation on your behalf and expressed that very clearly to the legislature. If there's a very small technical issue in House Bill 2001 that I can discuss offline if you like. It's not an emergency to address right now. If there's an opportunity, I might try to just get it fixed. There's a larger conversation ongoing about some technical questions around how House Bill 2003 works, and the staff here had a big conversation today, and we're going to continue to have those conversations both internally and with the rulemaking in the context of the rulemaking process, and there may be some kind of fix forthcoming in the legislature that I'm happy to detail if it is forthcoming. Councillor.
If I may.
Oh, please.
I'm being collaterally lobbied by another interest that perceives we were reluctant participants or even obstructive toward the adoption of 2003 because of the reasonable questions you asked about how to measure things. I'd like to debrief offline with you,
sure,
about that.
Sure, be happy to.
But also express my profound support for the idea that we get back to the business of inventorying housing needs and ensuring that zoning matches need in our communities.
As I say, the concerns that we've raised have primarily been technical, but I think there's a question as to whether the intent of that legislation can be carried out under the legislation as it was drafted. And so
that's an important technical.
Yes. I've got a meeting on Lisa and I have a meeting with a member of the speaker's staff tomorrow to discuss this issue, and it's going to be an ongoing conversation.
I would be delighted to be more informed about the question.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's complicated, and I might need some backup to have an intelligent conversation with you, but yes, we should do that.
You're not going to bring Ted Reed in, are you?
There were a lot of us talking about it today. Everyone agrees that with the intent of this legislation, which is to go forward and make it possible for more housing to be produced across the region. There's not a policy question there. There is a how question. And some technical, just, you know, I would say errors in the legislation that went forward. So that's.
I remember the blow by blow last session.
Yeah. So last session things were moving fast.
Yeah.
So the two issues that I want to spend maybe another moment on, a little bit more time on, I've got a few minutes here, are carbon. And then this transient lodging tax issue that I alluded to in the memo. Now, I also alluded in the memo that I was going to send you a fuller, larger memo on that. And let me just kind of make this conversation about it. I'll start there as a placeholder because we have a lot more learning to do about what's being proposed there. But just as a little refresher, and not even a refresher for some of you because you weren't here at the time, in 2016, the legislature increased the transient lodging tax for the purpose primarily of funding or supporting the 2021 track and field world championships that are going to be held in Eugene. And so at the time there was quite a bit of controversy about whether the transient lodging tax, the state portion of the transient lodging tax, should be raised permanently or for how long and by how much. And our interest at the time that we expressed very energetically was in minimizing the increase in the state transient lodging tax, and Scott can help me out if I, he lived through it just, you know, with me. In minimizing the increase in the state transient lodging tax for a couple of reasons. One, to keep our convention center and our visitor venues here competitive in a national market, and two, to maintain some headroom for a potential future increase in the regional transient lodging tax, which would all come to the region as opposed to just a portion of the state transient lodging tax. And there was ultimately a compromise reached where the increase that had originally been proposed was reduced, and then there was a commitment to reduce it further after 4 years. Those 4 years expire in 2020. And now there's a sense from a variety of interests that there's money on the table, because what if we just don't sunset that transient lodging tax? The position that Metro took at the time, and it was expressed, that I can send you around the floor statement that I distributed, was that we could support that compromise on the condition that the tax expire in 4 years. However, that may or may not be your position now, and I don't think I want to ask you for your position now, because I'd like to provide more information to you before that happens, but there are a number of potential directions this could go. The sunset could just be lifted, and the tax could continue to go into tourism development. The governor, by the way, has, I believe, is thinking about this as one of the funding sources for, I think, some more money that's needed for the track and field event.
They haven't raised much outside the state contribution, from what I read in the press. They're way behind.
Then you know more than I do.
you
read the press. I understand that's part of the proposal. And then housing interests, I believe the Housing Alliance has floated the idea of that increment that would otherwise sunset being devoted to rental assistance, and with the nexus to the transit lodging tax being the difficulty that people have in especially tourism-dependent communities in finding affordable housing, especially the people that work in those communities. There are a variety of proposals. It's not clear which way this is going to go or if any of them will move forward. I'd like to put a placeholder for a little bit further conversation with you about this when we know more. And I will be asking for policy direction, which I'm not necessarily thinking will be exactly identical to what you gave me 4 years ago. I just want to articulate that early and then let you know that I'm going to be coming forward with more information. And then finally, let me have a sip of water.
Hey, Randy, it might be helpful if you haven't already just to share what percentage of that statewide tax is generated here in Portland.
Is it? It's a majority, right? I don't know, actually, Scott.
Portland by itself is about 45%
right
of all of the statewide lodging tax. So we're talking about amount of money that's a great percentage of it raised in Portland that's being used statewide.
Mm-hmm.
Which could impact this discussion at a later date.
As long as we're getting about 50% of it back, I don't see any problem.
Well, right now we're not.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, and just to be a little bit specific, the lodging tax was 1% before 2016, and it ended up going to 1.8%, and then it's supposed to drop down to 1.5% in next year. So that's the numbers. And I'll also try to get you some numbers about how much that raises and how much money that actually represents. Finally, I would like to speak to you about carbon legislation. I sent you a memo a month or so ago, a month and a half ago or so, saying there's a lot of moving pieces here, and there still are a lot of moving pieces. There are at least there's at least a couple of different sort of locations in the House, and at least one or two in the Senate, as well as the governor's office, where different proposals are being put together. So it's going to be a little while before, or I don't know exactly how long, but a little bit before this sort of shakes out. But as you know, Everyone has said that passing legislation on carbon is their top, or at least all the leadership and the governor have said that passing carbon legislation in 2020 are their top priorities. The primary objective that I've been pursuing has been to ensure that if a cap and invest program is established and generates auction proceeds from the sale of allowances to emit from transportation fuels, that appropriate portion of those dollars be directed back to the region for the implementation of the Climate Smart Strategy. They're the perfect funding source for this particular use. JPAC passed a resolution unanimously, I believe, in February, March, that endorsed three things, essentially, that these proceeds should be, an appropriate share of the proceeds should be directed to the region for the implementation of the Climate Smart Strategy, that it should be spent in a way that gets the most impact per dollar spent in terms of greenhouse gas reduction, and that it be that those dollars be allocated through a regional process rather than a state process, essentially, through a transparent, streamlined, regionally collaborative process. And so that's the policy direction I've been pursuing, and there are a couple of the different places that bills are being developed that are actively working to move forward something along those lines. There are a lot of different ways that could shake out, and everyone wants to talk to everyone on this one. It's hard to have all the conversations you need to have. But I just want to, A, let you know that that's what I'm pursuing, that right now it seems to me, barring unforeseen legislation like the top priority that we might be working on this session, anything could happen, like I say, with this legislation. I guess to propose a set of principles around the work that I'm doing on this, the way I'm operating right now is to assume that this money is intended for greenhouse gas reduction. It is climate money. It's not just general transportation money, even though in theory it could be spent any way within the road right-of-way.
Absent legislative direction, to be more precise.
Correct. If it's raised from transportation fuels, unless the bill says otherwise, it's transportation dollars. The last version of the bill did say otherwise. It said, here's how we want it to spend. We want it spent to reduce greenhouse gas emissions or to support adaptation of communities or to support impacted communities, essentially. So the second principle is, which is consistent with the JPAC resolution, is that this money should be spent pursuant to a plan that has been approved by the state as actually achieving the emissions reductions that are consistent with the state's climate goals. And so the third principle that I'm operating under is that there should be some accountability. As you know, Metro is accountable to the state for the implementation of the Climate Smart Strategy, for achieving the targets over time that are in that strategy. And so there are lots of different ways that a proposal that directs money back to the region could be shaped. The principle that I'm suggesting is that however money comes back to the region, that it be accountable for the achievement of the goals that we've been assigned to achieve. And so lots more conversation to be had about this. I'm going to have to, meet with some of you or meet with all of you probably before I'm next in front of you for a work session and give you, much more detail and, have much more conversation. I'm happy to have some conversation now, of course. That's what I'm here for. So just wanted to put that out there. And I don't have – oh, just my final note, I guess, before I ask you if you want to – if you have questions about that, is that just procedurally, what I always do is I come back to you in January. I'll have another work session with you in January. It's not yet scheduled. I'm working with Sara to set that up. And then to come back to you with a resolution with – two attachments. One would be your priorities, and one would be your principles. And so that's the plan for January. So I'm happy to...
Councillor Stacey and then Lewis.
Colleagues, just a small piece of history. In 2009, the Metro Council sent Carl Hostica, their legislative liaison, to Salem to testify in support of what is now Climate Smart, imposing that requirement on the region as part of the transportation funding measure in 2009, with the request that the Legislative Assembly direct some funds to Metro to implement the Climate Smart plan with its partners in local government. Metro did that work. Now we're talking about a source of revenue that's derived from carbon emissions in the transportation sector that could fund the infrastructure components of Climate Smart. So it's a continuum of Metro working at legislative direction and cooperatively with the legislature, and this is just the next follow-up step to get the revenues, as Randy is describing them, to continue to carry out this thing that was established a decade ago. So, end of commercial message.
So I am definitely very supportive of continuing along the path of the priorities that have been laid out, and I haven't done a deep reading of the principles, so I'm glad that we've got a little bit of time before we have to kind of check that one off. When I think about the top priority for session, it's in my mind definitely carbon, but understanding the tensions at play between coming up with a bill that's going to do the most good for the whole state versus making something that's the perfect for Metro. And I guess I'm just going to be upfront that I'm going to trust the legislators in our region to be looking out for both interests. And continuing to tell them what I know about what would be best for us and advocating for policy that complies with JPAC. But I think we're already on a tightrope, and to empower Randy to be as agile as possible in Salem and put trust in him and know that between him and legislators, if they know what our position is, we kind of got to take the leap of faith on that one, just in having a number of conversations with folks more deeply involved. I think we're already at a point where it's like all we can do is say, look, here's the JPAC position. Here's what we need you to keep in mind. And then just go out there and advocate for the absolute need for this thing, because it's not something we can tackle regionally, and it's such a large and pressing problem if we don't take action. Now's our shot.
Yeah, I'm not counseling anything like opposing a bill that doesn't take care of climate smart funding. We need to tax carbon.
I'm not speaking in response to your statement. What I'm saying is that's our top priority, and there can be gives either in that bill or frankly with the rest of our agenda that we're not going to see, and we just have to know that that's okay.
Understood.
Can I just, I just wanted to say thank you for the comment about being agile, because this is definitely a moving target. It's going to be a moving target, I think, right on through the session. And I obviously check back with you as much as I can during the session, but things are going to happen. So thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm speaking broadly. Like,
yeah.
When we come back and have prioritized lists, like in my mind, the front page of the thing is carbon.
Yeah.
The next page is the other 1, 2, 3, 4 bullet points, and then we have our principles. Like, I want it to be loud and clear. Like, if there are places to give, it's not on carbon.
Right. Thank you.
I want to echo the sentiments. Carbon is definitely my priority. I know that my colleagues on the council share that priority, and anything that we can do to really emphasize that it needs to get done in 2020. And I would also ask for you to leverage us in whatever way that might be appropriate. Or inappropriate, I don't know, as long as we're able to achieve it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randy.
Well, one is, I had a comment on the transient lodging tax, and then also a related comment about services. I think that's an appropriate strategy to engage in, and rent assistance is the right is a an incredibly valuable need for us. I also am sensitive to the fact that that is funding that is going out of our essentially region, and so if we have some alternative kind of a strategy, I think that would be interesting to look at. You know, if we had a localized strategy to say, hey, let's compare these to help us weigh in on whether or not we want to participate in a statewide strategy versus something more localized. Because what essentially is happening is if the statewide one gets raised up, then that really kind of eliminates our ability to raise up our revenue. And I think that's the
right.
The issue there. So I appreciate you bringing that to our attention. It does kind of tie in a little bit to what I think may be something for us to consider, and I haven't brought this up with you before, so I'm kind of throwing this out there. But around the legislative principles and the issues of equity and housing are essentially, let's say housing is essentially a tool. It is not in this large debate we could have. It's not a principle. It's a tool to address poverty and equity and one of the best tools we have at our disposal to utilize. The other area that I think is going to be continuing to emerge as an important area is around the service side of housing. And so, and it's not the service side of housing that ties into housing, but services that address homelessness and support people in housing. So that is, rent assistance, I think, is a very important tool that I think can tie into built housing and allow us to make sure those services are in place. But also, not necessarily housing, but case management for substance use disorder, for mental health case management support, resident services to permanent supportive housing. These are, I think, principles or tools that, really kind of are part of addressing that principle of equity and poverty and making sure everybody has the opportunity to succeed in our region. And I think that's something that we ought to think about as a component of our legislative principles. For example, I don't think it's on the docket this legislative session, but, the gross receipts tax is only available statewide. It's not available for us here in the region. It is one of the most powerful tools in terms of revenue generation that we could utilize to support ongoing services in that area that would be right in our wheelhouse in terms of tying into the programs that we have around our housing in terms of addressing one of the number one regional priorities on voters' minds, which is addressing homelessness and the housing crisis. And so I think that's something that we ought to have on our mind and look for opportunities to seize if that is something that develops either in this miraculously in this short legislative session. I've not heard that it is developing,
right.
But should there be something there, to me, I would wholeheartedly stand behind an effort to look hard at that. And then also thinking about long-term, where does that potentially fit in a longer-term strategy, in a longer-term session.
Are you specifically speaking of the commercial activity tax or the gross receipts tax, or are you speaking more broadly right now?
I'm
just want to make sure I understand.
To both, which is that I'm speaking to the principle of addressing poverty and homelessness, essentially, and equity.
The service side as well.
The services
are
needed
side.
To do
yeah.
that.
Right.
There are a myriad of ways to do that. You've identified through the transient lodging tax, which, there's one place to get some revenue. I think specifically the gross receipts tax should be something that we have on our minds as a strategy to get there and would be worth a mention somewhere in our materials as is appropriate and where it fits in.
I believe there is at least a principle on preemption. That one is not as It's too specific. I'll look more carefully. I think there's a funding one as well farther in. But I'll thank you. I got a note.
And it's preemption, very important. But that's not necessarily the only thing I'm thinking of. I mean, I think a statewide gross receipts tax is available to us currently, and to me is a ideal solution, which, when you look at the kinds of things that voters will support, I've waited a lifetime to see the kind of numbers that you see when you look at a gross receipts tax and how it holds up in conservative and liberal communities as a tool to address services and poverty. So it's just an exceptional opportunity that is out there in our state right now that I don't think we are jumping on statewide, that I think is something that, if that is something that develops, I would want to just be right in there in the mix, maybe even helping lead efforts in that area.
Thank you. So. Thank you. I think I got the gist. The one comment I wanted to make in response to Councillor Gonzalez's comment about using you to help with this effort. That's one of the things that Annalisa and I will be actually working with you on, to try to see if we can facilitate some timely strategic meetings with the members of the legislature that are in your districts. And so I just wanted to flag that, because I think it is important, especially with this with the short session coming, for people to know where we're coming from. So anyway, I just wanted to let you know that we're planning to do that. I've got nothing more.
You've got more?
I've got nothing more.
Nothing more. Thank you.
I always have more.
You've got, yes, you do. You've got a lot.
Thank you.
So, thank you. And we move on to our acting chief operating officer. Is that deputy chief operating? Acting deputy chief operating officer.
Oh, my God.
We're just having
stop pretend. We look forward to your report.
Thank you, Deputy Council President and Councilors. You may call me as you wish. But I have a few announcements for you today. One is that the community placemaking grants are now open, and we hope you'll share that with your networks. Metro's community placemaking grants help people tackle challenges or opportunities by supporting arts-based, equity-focused efforts. Up to $190,000 is available for the 2020 cycle in grants ranging from $5,000 to $25,000. No matching funds are required. Since it began in 2017, this program of the Planning and Development Department has funded 23 projects supporting our Black, Indigenous, Latinx, Asian, and Pacific Islander, Muslim, at-risk youth, disabled youth, LGBTQ, and immigrant and refugee communities. Applications will be accepted through Monday, February 3rd, 2020. Some training and leadership opportunities for our teams. To help provide additional training options for teams here at Metro, we recently purchased two training passes with Learning Point, a training group comprised of local training professionals. Leveraging in with this network of consulting professionals, we now have two seats to all training sessions provided by this group. Training sessions focus in on improving performance for current managers and supervisors, as well as growing and cultivating future leaders. These opportunities provide practical training solutions with tangible tools for employees to implement. And last, I will share a building security issue that's coming upon us. To help everybody get ready for our go-live date of December 16th, Campus Ops will be handing out all types of badge-wearing swag to help you display your badge in whatever way is most comfortable for you. So come see us in the MRC lobby between 12 and 1 on Thursday, December 5th, Tuesday, December 10th, Thursday, December 12th. The main idea here is that we are adding a higher level of access to the building here, and so people coming into the building will need to identify themselves as a representative of Metro, one of our venues, or sign in for a visitor's pass. Okay?
By showing the card, the employee card.
Right. So we want to be able to have our security staff, who is now focused at our front desk, our staff to come in and identify themselves not make the assumption that they should know who they are, and avoid conflict, and make it easy and reasonable for them to know that we should have access to the building. And others that don't have a name badge with whatever type of holder they would want, have the opportunity to sign in and share the reason for their business, and I guess be in some fashion screened as somebody who should be here.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any chance we can just point to our picture on the wall when we come in?
Good. You know,
I used to be jealous.
You just carry it with you.
You just have a little pin that says "Member of Congress." I'd have to get this thing out and wave it at people.
We're getting those pins.
Are we? Mm-hmm. Oh, deal. I'm sorry. That's very selfish of me. I shouldn't even mention things like that.
I'll keep that here.
We're putting you on the spot as you fill in here. So, anyway, Councillor Communications. Any?
What you said about the grocery receipts tax.
Happy holidays.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, the council work session is adjourned. Thank you.